Okay, today is Monday, the 23rd of November, 2015. This is the fifth of our interviews with members of the League of Women Voters. And today we're talking with Louise Allen, who is a longtime member of League. And with us is Anka Voss, who is the director here at the Urbana, Champaign County Archives, and myself, Barbara Wysocki. Let's start, Louise, by telling us a little bit about your family background.
Well, I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. I became interested in foreign languages as a child because I lived across the street from the consul for Mexico and his family and played with their children and was quite fascinated that these children spoke one language to their dad and a different language to their mother. Actually, I also had a children's encyclopedia that is now long gone called the Book of Knowledge, which had little lessons in French. So I became somewhat literate, or not literate, but vocal in Spanish through the kids across the street. And shortly after that had happened, then I became somewhat vocal in French because the consul for Belgium, who was a French speaker, although his wife was a Fleming, lived not too far away also. So I did major in languages, Romance languages, all the way through the PhD. And my first interest in the League really had to do with the foreign affairs issues. When I joined the League, which was in 1960, that'll give you some idea how long ago, the big issue at that time was debt, and you never heard of debt, but it was the predecessor to some of the present relationships, including the foreign affairs agreement that President Obama signed recently with the Pacific nations. GATT had, in its turn, grown out of concerns with tariffs, which do go back to the foundation of the United States, of course. So this was a long-time history. My first League position was as chair of the Committee on Foreign Relations.
So when did you first come to Champaign?
I came to Champaign in 1952 as a graduate student. I had taken bachelor and master's degrees at the University of Kansas, and I came to Illinois originally to teach at Blackburn College in Carlinville, which in those days was a two-year institution. It's now a four-year liberal arts college, which was founded in 1827, I believe, a very, very old liberal arts college. And then gradually, I had done nothing but go to school from the time I was five until I was in my 20s. But after a few years at Blackburn, I realized that I did want to come back to school and take some more language work. So I came up here as a graduate student in 52.
And do you remember what your first impressions of this community were?
Well, Champaign-Urbana was a very different place then, as I'm sure you realize, from what it is now. I was shocked, to be candid about it. I had grown up in segregated Missouri. I thought, having come to Illinois, that I had moved away from all of that. And I was dismayed, I guess is the right word, to find that Champaign-Urbana was very segregated in those days. People of color lived not just on the north side, as they still do, but in absolutely dreadful circumstances. The first impression that I got was I had a fellow graduate student with whom I became friendly quite quickly, who was from Jamaica, and she was what is known in that part of the world as a quadroon, that is to say, she was a quarter of color. She and I went to the movies one night at the Co-Ed Theater, which isn't here anymore, but was until fairly recently. It was the movie theater on the U of I campus. And to my astonishment, they told us we had to sit in the balcony. Well, I was accustomed to having to sit in the balcony with friends of color, but I didn't expect to find it here. And so that aspect of Champaign-Urbana I found very off-putting. However, there were many other aspects that I found very delightful. The university was, of course, much smaller than it is now. It had about 15,000 students then. But it had, over the boardwalk, where now there are no trees, there was an overarch of elm trees.
Oh.
Which died in the elm disease in the later 50s. Very sad, but it was beautiful beyond belief. Another thing I found interesting was political candidates did not speak on the U of I campus. They spoke at the Y across the street.
Okay.
And that was true through when Richard Nixon was vice president. He came here on a campaign speech, actually in support of a man named Meek, who was running for governor at the time. And he spoke at the Y. The first political candidate to speak on the U of I campus was John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Huh.
And by that time, I had done what I used to call committing academic suicide. I married a colleague in the same department. And in those days, there were very strong nepotism rules. And the question was, which of you is leaving? And since he had tenure and rank and so forth, it wasn't a whole lot of question. But in any case, we had two little girls by the time that Kennedy spoke on the campus. And I dressed them up in their snowsuits and little hats and whatnot and boots to go and see the future president, which was kind of interesting. People sometimes ask me about how I got interested in the league, and interestingly, it was my husband who created that attention. My husband was not exactly a professional politician, but he did run for the city council in Urbana before we were married, and I believe that he lost by the smallest margin of any Democratic candidate up to that time. That will amuse you, because now, of course, the Democratic Party in Urbana is very strong. But it was not at the time of which we speak. Anyhow, he had done some work with a number of women whom he had found impressive. One of them was Evelyn Berdahl, whose husband was at that time the chairman of the political science department of the university. And another was Ruth Elmy, whose husband was later chairman of the physics department, and there were several others that Joe had worked with and found impressive. And he discovered fairly soon that we had back-to-back neighbors who were, the woman was a member of the league, and he suggested that I should go to some unit meetings. And it happened that she had one at her house fairly shortly after that, and that's how I got started going to the League. Mm. My very first League meeting was about foreign affairs. In fact, it was about the GATT, and the chief speaker was Marianne Ferber, who later was professor of economics and the founder of the Women's Studies program at the U of I. But at that time, because she also was a faculty wife, she was unemployed, and she was shortly after my time president of the League. She gave an absolutely stunning talk on the contents and concerns about that we should be looking at as we looked at development of international economic relations. This was, of course, not too long after the end of World War II. And the whole structure of what we now think of as globalization was just in its baby infancy. Yeah. And Marianne was very foresighted and very elegant in the way that she laid out what we needed to think about. Hmm. And I was hooked. I joined the League that day.
So is it the League that kind of framed your social and political work here in Champaign County?
Yes, very definitely. Although I have also, I was a member of several boards, including the Champaign Public Library Board, the MTD, the Mass Transit Board, some of those were started with right. League involvement yeah. as observer and whatnot. But I was interested in political issues, even as a youngster. I mentioned growing up in Kansas City. Kansas City was town, one of the famous towns that was machine ridden. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, the head of the local machine went to prison for a year and a day while I was in high school. And I knew him and his family slightly. They were smart people. If you ever want to do a political machine, take this one into account. I used to say that I was 16 before I ever saw a burned out street light. That's almost true. If it snowed at night, the main thoroughfares were absolutely cleaned by 5 o'clock in the morning. That we lived on a side street, which was a couple of blocks from a main thoroughfare. It was always cleaned by 7.
Wow.
In other words, the services were magnificent. The machine made its money out of two things, liquor and concrete. And we had a lot of things that were paved in concrete. We built a lot of schools, we paved a lot of roads, and at one point they sort of ran out of things to pave, so they paved the local brook that ran through
oh my gosh.
One large part of the city. And it is paved to this day.
Wow.
But the idea of that very interesting machine was to keep the public happy mm-hmm. by giving them good service.
And jobs.
And do the other stuff behind the doors. Harry Truman, who of course was President of the United States later, was the chief judge of the county, Jackson County, when I was a kid. And he was, a well-run machine also has at least one honest person in front of him. And he was that guy. But because of that, and because women had gotten a vote just 5 years before I was born. I became interested in political issues as quite a youngster.
Yeah. One of your main contributions, one of your big roles, I think, has been in the formation of Parkland College.
Yes, I was the observer for the organization that developed Parkland's first involvement in legislation that led to the community college system in the state of Illinois, which has an interesting league story that you may not know. A former state league president named Marjorie Pebworth had been elected to the state senate of Illinois in the 1960s, and that was the time at which the community college movement nationally was developing, particularly in the Midwest. It had developed in California and in the East Coast, but in the Midwest it was a new idea at that time. And Marjorie tried very hard to sponsor community college legislation for Illinois. She didn't get it through two or three sessions of the legislature, and then, very regrettably, she had a heart attack and died suddenly. There was a man named Russell Ainsworth, who was then the state leader of the Senate for, Cullerton is the guy that has that role now.
Okay.
And at the memorial for Marjorie, he said, "Hey guys, let's pass that community college legislation as a tribute to Marjorie. And they did. And that's how the community college legislation in Illinois was passed in 1965. Champaign County was one of the first counties that became interested in creating a community college, which in a way was kind of odd, because a lot of people in this town wrote a lot of letters to, at that time there were two newspapers, about what does the home of the University of Illinois need with another institution of higher education. Think about that for a second, okay? So, but there were two men, William Froom, who was the chairman at that time of the Unit 4, that is Champaign Public School District Board, and Charles Ziprot, who was at that time mayor of Urbana, who were friends, and they had a third friend who was a member of the education department at the U of I. The three of them decided that Champaign-Urbana needed a community college, or the Champaign County did, and they organized the group that promoted the legislation, the local legislation, as soon as the state legislation had been passed. This was a very interesting, very hardworking, very dedicated group of people who were seriously interested in education and knew quite a bit about higher education. And so it was a very valuable enterprise. And Champaign County was one of the first counties to pass the local legislation, which of course created the local district. And I was the league observer for that group before it became, as it eventually did, the Parkland College Board. Now, the Parkland College District includes parts of 12 counties. It's a big district. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman that I've mentioned all campaigned very hard to get the support that was needed throughout the district, and were successful in getting that done. By the time that the legislation, the local legislation was actually passed, I had been elected president of the Champaign Public County League, and so I presided at the first candidate forum for the Parkland board. Mm-hmm. We had 21 candidates for that board, and they were very superior people. It was a very strong board. And the original seven who were elected were included both Messrs. Broom and Ziprod, whom I've already mentioned, and several other locally strong folks. So Parkland got off to a very good start, and we opened actually with 1,300 students, which was a very good number at that time. Mm-hmm. In those days, Parkland was located down in downtown Champaign, mm-hmm. as you may know, and what is now the Thai restaurant at the corner of Randolph, I guess it is, and Church Street, was where the students' activities were located and where a lot of the faculty offices, including mine, mm-hmm. were located early on. When the board was organized, they hired Dr. Bill Starkle, who was the first president, and he hired a man named Smith, who was the first dean. I applied for a job, and although I was surprised, I got it. The reason I was surprised was that by that time I'd done a lot of community reading about community colleges, and I knew they didn't really want PhDs. And I teased Dean Smith later by telling him that when I was hiring for the kind of position that I had, that I wouldn't have hired me. But he laughed. So yes, I was a founding faculty member there. It was a most exciting undertaking to be at the beginning of something so new. Mm-hmm. Not only was it a new institution, but it was a new idea. And the notion that 1 year and 2 year career programs should be very important in higher education was brand new to this community. The idea that, well, the notion to begin with was that most of the Parkland students would be transfer oriented and would go to the U of I. To this day, that is still an important part of Parkland mission. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is the most active and vital part of the mission from the beginning has been the career mm-hmm. programs. Mm-hmm. In fact, I was the first chair of what we called in those days divisions, mm-hmm. and most of the people who were under my supervision were humanities and fine arts and so forth people. And I realized pretty quickly that if we didn't want to get walked all over on by the career people, we better have a career program with you. So I went to work talking to people around town and eventually developed with a lot of tremendously helpful assistance from league members and from people in the community, what is now the communications organization there that teaches a great deal of, radio, television, we started with. Now, I suppose their biggest involvement is in computer-oriented communications work, which is, of course, very large at Parkland these days. And so that was one of the interesting things, too. I did teach some Spanish while I was there, might add.
Oh, great. So within the league organization itself here, you mentioned earlier that it was the emphasis on foreign affairs that really sucked you in. What league activities did you engage in?
Well, let me back up and say something that I really should have probably brought up earlier, and that is the shock that I had coming to the community about the degree of segregation. Also was very important to me in my league activities, because just about the time I joined, the question of effective integration of the public schools came up. And the residential patterns were such that this involved quite a lot of under the table, if you will, work, because most people of color lived in one set of neighborhoods in both towns.
Yeah.
And most white people lived in other neighborhoods. And there were some rather ugly developments. One of the things that the league did actually just before I joined was a very effective and important study which became known as the Shack Study. And the Shack Study was about the living quarters of people of color in Champaign and Urbana, and the word shack was highly appropriate. That study was so effective that it actually embarrassed both towns and the public school boards in both towns into taking a serious look at the way that people of color lived in this town. I can tell you just as a quick example, I had a cleaning lady when my children were small who lived on Ash Street, which was one of the really wretched streets in the north side. Her house, because her husband was a retired maintenance man on the Illinois Central Railroad, was the only one on her block that had indoor plumbing and central heating.
Wow.
This was in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah.
People come here and hear about that sort of thing and say, what did the league do? Well, the league embarrassed these communities by putting the spotlight on things like that block of Ash Street, into taking some really serious movements toward integrating the communities and the schools. And you look at the immense progress that has been made since then, and you really have to be impressed.
Yeah.
So that's something else I should mention.
Yes, definitely.
I was not personally involved in the Shack Study, but I was very much involved in the integration studies and in the other aspects of that followed.
Okay, good. You also played a significant role in the state league.
Yes. At the time that I joined the league, the local president was Helen, Mrs. Ezra Levin. And I'm happy to say that Helen is still living. She is 102 years old. She is one of the most impressive women I have ever known in my life. I wish that she were well enough that you were able to interview her for this series, but her health is such that that isn't feasible at this time. But she became, very shortly after I joined the league, state president. And she was later, as a matter of fact, the national treasurer of the League of Women Voters. And it's my belief that she would have been the national president, except that her husband, Ezra Levin, who was a chemist and a businessman of a great deal of talent and regard, who had a business in Mahomet, which is, not Mahomet, I'm sorry, Monticello, which is still very much in business now. His health began to fail, and while Helen was the national treasurer, and I think it was that caused her not to be be the national president. The Champaign County League was an important league on the state board, not only because Helen was the state president, and then later Dorothy O'Neill, who is also still living, was the state president, but also because there were a number of us who were on the state board through the years. Debbie Rugg, who is still very active, Sandy Volk, who was now the state treasurer of this league, and several others were members. And the first national convention that I went to illustrated, I think, in a funny sort of way, how important this league was in Illinois. They had a series of small group meetings of leagues according to the size and interest of the league at the state convention. And we were placed in a large suburban league group. And we said, well, what are we suburban to? We're 130 miles from Chicago and about the same from St. Louis. And they said, well, the kind of league that you are is more like Princeton, New Jersey, and Baltimore County, Maryland, and some of the suburbs of San Francisco and Los Angeles in California, than it is like any other. So that's why we're putting you in this large suburban league group, even though you aren't really suburban. But yes, the fact that this league was heavily dominated, and I will be honest about that, by women who were associated. A number of the issues that were important statewide at that time were also significant here locally, and one of those, well, let me just list several. One was mental health. There was a time when, and I think you've interviewed Janet Anderson, mm-hmm. and she may have talked about this, I don't know. But there was a time when there were a lot of mental health institutions in Illinois, and where people were sent. And those were abolished in Illinois, as in a number of other states. And the question was, what do we do with people who have mental health problems? They can't all live at home. They can't all go to public schools unless we do some very significant things about the public schools. There are just lots of things that they can't do. So there was a major state study of mental health concerns and how to deal with mental health cases in light of the abolition of the state institutions. Now, the institutions, a lot of them were bad stuff, and they deserve to be abolished. But at the same time, the question was there. So that was one that was of a great deal of interest here. Obviously, the whole issue of higher education was very significant to this league. And indeed, most of the women who were among the original founders of this league, and incidentally, this league is one of the oldest leagues in the United States. It was founded just 2 years after the League of Women Voters of the United States. And many of those women were university wives who had come here with their husbands, and I've already mentioned the nepotism rules, so they couldn't teach at the university, although many of them were qualified to do so. And they had homes and children and activities, but they also had a lot of talent, a lot of articulateness. There were speakers of real talent. There were lots of women who were very interested in digging into things and finding out, you know, what's the whole story. So this league got out to a very good start in that regard and was prominent with state issues. Another of the state issues that was picked up here after being designed originally in the Chicago area had to do with court services. You may have heard of the Gaylord scandal, which was a court scandal in Cook County in the Chicago area that proved beyond very much doubt that there was a great deal of corruption in the court system in Cook County. And that became a state study run from and by the state board. Actually here, we continued that study after the state had finished its involvement, and the Gaylord matter, incidentally, had been put to rest. Which was, again, the league was influential. Not this league so much as the state league mm-hmm. in that regard. We did continuing study, which actually is still alive in Champaign County, of state and local activities in the courts. That has been an important involvement. Obviously, financing the league became a major issue. And again, there were people of considerable talent with financial concerns, fundraising, et cetera, here, who were active throughout the state. So this league had a leadership role, probably more than any other downstate league, for many years. Now I think people tend to think of the Illinois League as essentially Chicago and suburbs, and to some extent that is true. But I would like to see Champaign-Urbana and incidentally also Carbondale as active as they once were in the Illinois issues.
Mm-hmm. In my notation here, did our league have a radio show?
Yes. We had television, too.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Deb included that in this outline, and mm-hmm. I'm like,
yeah.
What is she
for
talking about?
For considerable years, we had an hour a week show on WILL radio, in which we talked about matters that we were studying at the time. And in fact, I can tell you a funny personal story. One of my stepsons married a lovely young woman whose family were members of a big synagogue in the North Shore and had a very prominent and very famous rabbi. At the reception, from the wedding, the rabbi shook hands with me and said, "I know your voice. You're the woman who tells me about foreign affairs." I said, "Where or how or something?" He said, "On WILL radio." Well, I don't know that you've ever looked at the footprint of WILL radio, but it's very long north to south, yes. Not very long east to west.
Yeah.
And this gentleman did a lot of congregational calls in his car, and he said he always had his car radio tuned to WILL while he was doing congregational calls, and that the lead program was one that he always listened to. And I just happened that I was doing, I think the program was once a week, if I recall, and I was doing, I think, once a month or so on foreign affairs at that time. We also had when, you probably know that Channel 3 was the first and only television station in Champaign-Urbana or in the county for several years, and then all of a sudden we got an NBC outlet as well, and they were hard up for local programming. So we had a television show on that, and as a matter of fact, I was waiting for that show to come up. It was at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when the horrible announcement came that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated. Mm-hmm. And my children, interestingly, were home from school with a cold that day, and they told me later something that I didn't remember, which was what I was doing. I remembered seeing that come up on the TV with Walter Cronkite's very distinctive voice, and you've probably seen the famous picture of him taking off his glasses and so forth, saying that President Kennedy died at 1 o'clock this afternoon. I remember that very clearly, but I didn't remember what I was doing. My kids told me later, "Mom, you were ironing." And they were right. I remembered when they told me. But anyhow, we were pretty, and we also had all of our candidate meetings were broadcast on, most of them on both television and radio. As a matter of fact, this very afternoon, I heard Alex Ashlock, who used to be at WILL and is now at, Boston. One of the national stations for NPR. He was the guy who introduced most of our candidates' meetings for years while he was here. And so yes, we had a lot of exposure. Our candidate forums were preceded for quite a long time by an elaborate set of candidate interviews, and these were printed in the newspapers, and then the two newspapers took over doing really good candidate interviews. Yeah. And backgrounding and so forth. So the league stopped doing that I think probably in the late 70s, early 80s. But I don't think the newspapers would have done it as well had we not done it well.
Well, yes, you offered a great model, I think.
We did.
For them to pick up on and maybe even take it to another level. That's good.
And I myself did a 10-year stint as a panel interviewer on Parkland radio television when after we started the Parkland programs. Had some interesting stuff with local people of interest and note and so forth, kind of like what, it isn't done so much now, come to think, but the local commercial stations used to have interviews on their noon news broadcasts. And we had a long and expanded version of that. Most of their interviews were 5 to 7 minutes, something of that sort. We did a half an hour, and occasionally we did a full hour interview. Mm-hmm.
I never knew that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After all these years in League, what would you say is its greatest strength?
Well, I think the greatest strength, it goes back to the very beginning. The League was, of course, founded originally by suffragettes, by women who had been involved in getting women the right to vote in the United States. And indeed, as you probably know, the League was founded in Chicago in 1920, right after the women's suffrage bill had passed Congress. And it was founded with two, I think, very important ideas. One of which was, if women were going to vote, they ought to do that intelligently. Now, I remarked about that to a male friend of mine a while ago. He said, that was what your first mistake. That's as may be. But the other was that League action should be based on study. That is to say, if League was going to take a position, that the schools should be integrated, or that redistricting of legislative districts was important, or something of that sort, that it shouldn't just haul off and start expressing that opinion. It ought to make a study and find out why that was true, why that was important, why that was valuable. One of the most impressive League studies that I ever saw was done by the State League of the State of Washington many, many years ago of the water supplies in the state of Washington, which of course are to this day a matter of very important political value. And you may know that one of the things that was done at one point was building what they called fish ladders so that the salmon could get upstream,
right,
to spawn. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that was emphasized in that study done by the League, by the State League of the State of Washington. That kind of really deep dig into questions that had political value and yet were probably not going to be of huge political interest was what the League was founded originally to do. Mm-hmm. And I still think that action based on study is one of the League's great strengths.
And what would you say is the greatest challenge for League?
Right now it's membership. I've described to you a career that began shortly before women went back to work. You probably know about Rosie the Riveter in World War II, but you may not know that once the war was over, Rosie went back to being a housekeeper. And many League women were like the women who founded this League. They were college educated, they were intelligent, they were articulate. Many of them were good writers, and they didn't have any immediate opportunity through which to use those skills. I think that was one of the reasons that my husband Joe suggested that I should join the league was that he knew that I could read and write and do all that stuff. And he was right. So when women did start going back to work, actually I was president of the Champaign County League when the University of Illinois came up with a study which said that all department heads should have what amounted to an executive secretary or assistant to the department head. Mind you, they hadn't had that before. Something like 100 league members got jobs with, you know, almost days after that decision. I myself went back to work at Parkland College when it was brand new, and so did a number of other leaguers. And from that time on, and this is true, of course, not only of organizations like the League, it's true of many general organizations. Look at churches, look at political parties, look at Boy and Girl Scouts. It's been hard for all of these organizations to find the volunteers that they had prior to women's getting paid for doing what they were doing anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that is an issue. And frankly, the kind of study that I value so much in league's history is very difficult for leaguers to do now because most of them have jobs that require more of their time than it doesn't allow for that kind of study. So I think that's the big problem, is membership. And I suppose, sidebar with that, of course, is just general public notice. One thing that lots of people don't know is that the whole business of candidates' debates, league started that.
That's right.
And then the political parties took
them over. Yeah.
Okay. And I must say, I don't think they do it nearly as well as we did. But as recently as when Dorothy O'Neill was state president here in Illinois, she presided over the debates of Governor Thompson and whoever was running against him at the time, and I can't remember who that was. So that was in the late 70s or early 80s.
Yeah.
So some really good things like that the league's insistence on being nonpartisan. Now, that one always raises questions. I have friends here in Champaign-Urbana who say, well, the league is all Democrats. Here, that's the perception. And as a matter of fact, the first women who were elected to the Urbana City Council, eventually to the Champaign City Council, although it's supposed to be nonpartisan, to the county board and so forth, were elected as Democrats. And by and large, I would say that the political views of most leaguers in Champaign County are somewhat to the left of perhaps the general public. But you go to someplace like the Chicago suburbs, and the leagues up there are perceived as Republican.
Yeah, they are.
Because by and large, the membership is somewhat to the right of the general population. Mm-hmm. And especially that's true in some of the large cities, including Chicago. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting matter of perception. But it is something that the League has had to deal with.
Well, and it seems to me, because I run up against those biases all mm-hmm. the time too, mm-hmm. but it also seems to me that, I kind of know where the liberals are, where the mm-hmm. more conservatives are, but the beauty of it is that they work together so well. You know, the common goal is education.
That's right.
Child welfare. It's environment. It's, you know, and the political labels.
And the League insistence on nonpartisanship is real, even though it isn't always understood by the general public.
Yeah.
And so that I think is one of its great values.
True.
But I do think that one of the challenges, which is what you asked about, Barb, is trying to get that the realism straight in the public mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're about to conclude. God, this has been a fascinating conversation.
Good, thank you.
But I wanted to make sure that we addressed what you wanted to address. So if there's another topic out there.
Well, I suppose the one thing that I would like to talk about a little bit is where the League is headed.
Okay.
And because of the issues of membership, of lack of women's time and so forth, I have been for many years an advocate of changing the name of the organization, which not everybody agrees with me about. In fact, most people don't. Mm-hmm. But I would like the organization to be thought of as the League of Active Voters. And people may not realize it, but we do actually have male members. Mm-hmm. In fact, this league had a male president a while ago, who was Sam Gove, mm-hmm. Who was Mr. State Government of Illinois, founder and director for many years of the Institute of Government at the University of Illinois, co-author of two of the most influential books about Illinois state government and history, and he was a president of this league, a co-president, I guess I should say. I have a friend in Colorado who is a tall, dark, and handsome Latino who is a member of a league in Colorado. And his wife was on the Colorado State Board some years ago. They were in Washington on, I think, personal business. But she suddenly got a phone call from the League's national office saying that they needed somebody to come down and testify before a congressional committee the next morning. Well, she was tied up with whatever it was they were there for. And so she said, well, I can't go, but my husband is a league member and he's with me. Can I send him? And the national office said, sure. So here is this congressional committee. He walks in. They look at him and say, who are you? And he says, I'm the representative of the League of Women Voters. And he's 6 feet two, and as I say, a dark, handsome, could easily be a Latino movie star. they took some convincing, but they did take his testimony.
Good.
And it was
good.
Influential.
Good.
So I wish we had a lot more male members, frankly. And most importantly, I think developing the idea that the league is important, that the work it does can make a real difference, not only in local government, but also in state and in national government, needs a lot more publicity than it gets.
Yeah.
Once in a while, we do have a reporter who takes an interest in us. We had one on the Gazette for a while, who was very fascinated with our Observer Corps activity here in Champaign County, which, as you know, is very active. We observe something like 22 or some such number of local boards, commissions, and so on of local government, of which Illinois has more than any other state in the Union. And I believe we have more observers than any league except Cook County. So that is something valuable that people who don't have a great deal of time can think about undertaking, because most of those boards and committees meet at night or at least late in the afternoon when people with full-time jobs can be there, contribute, both as members of the organization itself and as league observers. And this league is very distinguished for its observer corps, and rightly so. Mm-hmm. And Mary Blair, whom you have interviewed, is one of the real stalwarts in making that go. And although she's retiring now, it's being taken over by Sue Phillips, who is equally talented.
Yes.
And hardworking.
Yes.
So that's another thing that I would like to see the league spend a lot of time with, and particularly the reports that the league observers write are very valuable documents, and they don't get enough publicity. The league observers are required not to talk, to listen to what the board or commission or group that they're observing is doing, and to report accurately what they do and, if possible, why they did that. And that's something that, particularly in the days we have now, when journalism and the media are not able to do the kind of dig yeah. stuff that they used to, that needs doing.
Yeah.
And that's a way to do it.
I agree. Well, thank you so much, Louise.
My pleasure.
Gun thank you. Fun.
You're such a storehouse of information.
I've enjoyed it enormously. And I'm lucky because I'm 90 years old, but I'm in good health by and large and able to continue doing things in spite of the fact that I'm legally blind. Point as in, if I can do something league-wise, please let me know.
I certainly will. I certainly will.
And bear in mind that we live in a time when extension of life is real. You know, the business about 60 is the new 40, I think is true.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that you younger women will keep up the good work.
Bless you.